Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of wildlife with our guest, Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. He stops by normally every other month to talk about the great outdoors, and he just got back from a trip to Alaska. So we're going to talk with him about that and answer your wildlife questions. So I hope you'll join in. Have you been to Alaska? What's your favorite memory of that trip? What wildlife questions do you have? Join in at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got a photo to send, just send that along in your email. We already have one in, and we'll talk about it in just a bit. But first, Scott Craven, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. It's good to be back. It was a terrific trip to Alaska, but it's always nice to get home. We were gone 16 days, and I had my work cut out for me in the garden and yard. Thanks to the family, the grass was mowed nicely, but there were still some things that needed attention.
So what about Alaska? It's not your first trip.
No, fourth trip, actually. Yeah. But most of the previous trips have either been business or fishing trips to lodges, and you don't get to see very much. But this one was a full-blown tourist tour, beginning in Fairbanks and 7 days on land down through Denali and Talkeetna and ending up on the Alaskan Railroad into Whittier and then get on a nice ship for 7 days down to Vancouver. So that was
wow.
And we spent a couple extra days there and went over to Vancouver Island and Victoria to see the Bouchard Gardens, which were
fabulous.
Spectacular. Yeah. Just incredible. I looked all over. There's got to be a weed here somewhere. There's got to be a leaf on the ground. There's got to be something. There wasn't.
No.
It was spectacular. So that was at the tail end. But I think the striking thing, first of all, I'd say that in terms of scenery, the highlight of the trip was Glacier Bay National Park. It's immense. It took us all day to steam up the bay into a couple arms and then back out. And as we entered, a team of Park Service naturalists boarded our ship, and then they provided narrative all day long over the ship's intercom and whatnot. So we knew what was going on, and they'd stop at a glacier, and the ship would simply sit there for a while so you could take all the pictures you want and look around. But the scenery, it was just spectacular. Now, it helped that we had glorious weather.
Yeah.
Alaska's not known for glorious weather, but we got lucky in that regard. So the day in Glacier Bay was crystal clear. The water was flat calm. It was like resting
man.
On a bowl of Jell-O. And it was... It's one of those things where not only in Glacier Bay, but most of the trip through Alaska, wherever you look, it looks like it should be a postcard.
Yeah.
And that doesn't get old. Even after 2 weeks, it's just a beautiful place. And then when you combine that with realizing that if you look at a map of land management and ownership and control in Alaska, it's virtually all ours. Most of it. The lion's share, there's very little private land in Alaska. It's either national park, national forest, state park, state forest, or indigenous people's land.
Yeah.
And, you know, that means wherever you look, you think, wow, this is going to stay this way. And it's ours. Everybody owns a piece of the pie, so to speak. And that's kind of a neat thing. And the other thing is it's immense.
Yeah.
You travel for 14 days, you never leave the same state, and you're always moving. You realize just how big it is, and those kinds of things are pretty interesting. The southeast coast, where most of the cruise ships travel, is all rainforest. And from one end to the other, I never saw a cut tree. And this is a big chunk of it is the Tongass National Forest, and that went through that battle a few years ago.
Yeah.
And it's protected now. But as soon as we crossed into British Columbia, into Canada, the sides of the mountains were covered with clear cuts. Now, that doesn't particularly bother me, because I understand, you know, trees are just
renewable resource.
It's a renewable resource. It's just long rotation corn, basically. And you'd see a cut that was 5 or 6 years old. It was already green again, albeit a different color or shade of green. But they were the Canadians were using the forest, and it was a big part of their economy in BC. Not so in Alaska, at least that part, which is highly visible. Anyway, so the forestry was of interest. The public lands were spectacular. Glacier Bay scenery. The other thing everybody does, and it's kind of a must-do, is the eight-hour bus tour into Denali National Park. You think, oh my God, 8 hours on a bus. I'm not sure I can do that. But it goes by quickly. The buses are modestly comfortable. And about every 90 minutes, they have these huge areas set up with very nice restroom facilities so everybody can get off the bus and stretch their legs and do what they need to do. So it was great. And again, that's just an incredible expanse of tundra, mountains, beautiful scenery, and everybody's in there to see the wildlife.
Yeah.
We got lucky, saw quite a few moose, quite a few caribou, lots of Dall sheep. But what I wanted to see was a grizzly, and we were all the way in, and about a third of the way back had not seen a bear. And then all of a sudden the driver said, oh, here we go. And a beautiful, huge, blonde, very blonde grizzly marched across the road down into the tundra and then just ambled off into the distance. And we sat there watching that. That was pretty cool. The other thing, that the idea that when we landed in Fairbanks at 12:30 in the morning, you could read a newspaper on the side of the street.
Yeah.
And then I realized, well, we're only a few days from the summer solstice, and from the day we landed in Fairbanks until we got to Vancouver, never saw darkness.
Oh.
And that was pretty cool. And anyway, there are other things we could come back to. The coolest thing, if we get back to talking about it in terms of the tourist attractions, my wife and I went out on one of the deadliest catch crab boats from the Bering Sea. Was Morden Ketchikan. We spent an afternoon on it, and we can tell that story if we have time. But that was pretty neat if people have seen that TV show on the Discovery Channel.
Well, it's pretty pretty cool, and the mass of the state is, one of my former PhD students, John Trent, went back and was in charge of the North Slope of Alaska. And you take the North Slope of Alaska, and it completely covers the state of Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and then some. Just that part, small part of Alaska. It's an amazing, amazing state, amazing place for us to visit. Well, let's talk about some other things. I bet you came back and found a bunch of chipmunks when
yes,
you got home.
Regular listeners may recall that I was lamenting a scourge of chipmunks the last time I was on a month ago, and I had, after I got off the air, I finally said I've had it with these chipmunks, and I procured a new chipmunk live trap at the request of the rest of the family, and I started utilizing it, and I quickly captured 17 chipmunks over 4.5 days. And I thought, wow, that's a lot of chipmunks. If they were all in a pile, that's a lot of chipmunks. But anyway, I was releasing them elsewhere, and I thought I had to jump on them, but we had to leave for Alaska, so we did. And I got back to find more chipmunks. So now I'm up to 23 after just being back for a couple of days, and there still seem to be some chipmunks. So in the process of lamenting this to a few other folks, I find out that other people have been having chipmunk problems this year.
Oh,
so
yeah.
There are a couple lessons to be learned here for folks at home. One is that if you see a chipmunk or anything else, the assumption that it's all by itself is probably
not true.
Nor is it possible to have some standard extrapolation, like if you see one rat, there's probably 50 of them in the barn. That doesn't work that well. But the point is, these small animals can be incredibly abundant. And if you think you're going to solve your problem by catching the one that happens to be sitting on the deck railing looking at you, probably not. So when you enter into a program to try and rid the yard of chipmunks, woodchuck, well, you know the woodchuck situation.
Yep.
How many did you remove under
13.
Your 13 woodchucks, and these are
big
animals, and that was under one deck. So the point is, you need to be aware of what you're getting into when you start trying to conduct a removal program, and think a little bit about how you want to approach this before you get involved. I wish I had.
Well, let's switch to high water, because certainly there's The Great Lakes and a lot of the rivers are up. There's probably some implications for some wildlife.
Well, yes. I'm headed from the show up to our cabin in Price County, and the advance guard of the family is already up there. And they said, well, the water's still high and everything is still late. Turtles were just nesting in the driveway last night. I got a picture from my wife. Four painted turtles frantically digging a nest in the middle of the driveway, but we'll get to that a little later. So there's still plenty of water, and the survey results attest to that. The DNR and the Fish and Wildlife Service monitor wetland conditions, particularly because of the relationship of that to waterfowl production in terms of nesting success. And as of the spring results, there were above average wetland conditions, lots of wetlands, and no surprise there. And it led to, in terms of the duck surveys at least, stable to increasing numbers of most of our major duck species. So there were
a lot
of wetlands. There still are. And as I drive around here in Dane County, I'm still seeing former soybean or cornfields that are still there are cattails emerging from some of these fields that have been submerged now for an extended period. So it's
yeah,
it's strange. I mean, it's always tough to be in the agricultural community, but looking out over your land and seeing most of it either mud or underwater is this time of year. You might expect it in March or April. It goes away, but it hasn't gone away this year.
Anna emailed to ask if you could identify a lizard that they found in their house in western Wisconsin. Picture isn't perfect. It scared her mom, and she squished it a little bit, but she's got a picture of this lizard next to a penny, and it's about the size of the penny, but the tail, with the exception of the tail, which is quite a bit longer.
Well, unbeknownst to most people, there are four different types of lizards in Wisconsin, but their range is pretty restricted, and this one's pretty tiny. And it is squished, and it's small.
<head.
laughs> So it's a little tricky, but because of the shape of the head, the coloration's not useful here, but the shape of the head and the very long hind feet and huge toes and the very long tail, I suspect it's a juvenile six-line race runner. That's one of our most widespread of the, and it's not widespread, of our lizards, of our four lizards. And if it were an adult, it would be very distinctively striped and colored, and it would be easy to identify it. But this is a juvenile, and it met an untimely end in her mother's house. But a six-line race runner, the other three, by process of elimination, two of the others are skinks, which tend to be a little stubbier and smaller and more salamander-like. The scales are very small, so they look sleek and shiny. This one doesn't. It has the race runners are much more scaly. And then the fourth one is a slender glass lizard, which looks for all the world like a snake. It's limbless, so that's not this in that case. And the skinks are restricted to, one, the prairie skink over toward Minnesota, and the blue-tailed skink in the central part of the state. So anyway, I think it's a race runner.
Scott Craven, our guest today, emeritus professor from the UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, our guest today. Questions for him or maybe an experience to share, join in at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us your question and maybe your photo to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife ecologist, emeritus professor from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Great to have him back. Give a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take some calls. Charles in Rush Lake will give you a chance now. Hi, Charles. Thank you for calling.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
So I have a rural property, and when I'm out in the yard or mowing the lawn or whatever, I have noticed more toads around the yard this year than I've ever seen before. Like, I can go out in the evening and see five or six of them right away. And I don't recall that being the case last summer or the previous summer when we were out here. So I just wondered if that was due to the incredible rain and moisture we've had the last couple seasons, or that's a climate change related thing, or just some anomaly on my property.
Are these little guys, you know, fingernail size, or good size adult toads?
No, you know, they're like palm of your hand, some of them. Not great big toads, but they're not little tiny ones.
Okay.
But, you know,
well,
lots of different sizes. And they're kind of a brownish-gray color.
Yep. Well, the good news is it's easy to be a toad expert in Wisconsin because we only have one species. So that makes things a little simple. And you're correct. I don't think we need to invoke climate change unless you blame the water and rain and water mm-hmm. conditions we have on that. But if you're from an amphibian's perspective, things have been pretty darn good for the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Lots of water in the spring for breeding, which they need, and the water's been amazingly persistent, especially this year. So in some cases, toads will get into a small breeding pond, like my little water garden in the backyard, which I keep full for them, and you know, they're pretty consistent from year to year, but in other places, they may get into a shallow wetland, and before the little toad poles can metamorphose and emerge, things dry up and they're out of luck. But that hasn't been the case. So I think reproduction for most of these animals has been pretty strong. And as a result, I guess I'd have to say I've been seeing lots of toads around the yard myself. And if you happen to be near a small pond when there's an emergence, when the tadpoles are metamorphosing, you can see hundreds, if not thousands, of these little fingernail-sized toads all scrambling across the environment to get somewhere where they're going to grow up and try and become big toads. And I don't think it's an anomaly for your property. I think it's a reflection of really good conditions, and they'll flourish for a while, and harder times will probably come at some point, but not now.
Just had on Facebook, my Facebook page, a friend of mine, Brian Korfmacher, has a cabin up north, was commenting on the number of bullfrogs.
Hmm.
And he says, I mean, it's really fun to hear those bullfrogs croaking away.
Well, it's they need to make hay while the sun shines,
yeah,
so to speak,
for sure.
And they seem to be doing it. So,
Charles, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Duke in Plover, we'll go to you next. Hi, Duke.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. A trout fisherman, and my typical river that I fish is the Tomorrow River, and the Hexagenia hatch on the Tomorrow River is very predictable at the time that it occurs, between 9 and 9:15 at night, and I've just recently become aware of a hex hatch on the upper Plover River that happens around noon. And which was news to me. I thought the hex hatch was typically nocturnal. Can you give me more information on that?
No. I don't mean to be brief, but I understand the hex hatch is a big deal for fly fishermen, and there are many people way more knowledgeable about that than I. I thought it was an evening phenomenon, too, and the folks I know who are avid fly fishermen get out on their favorite water just before dark, and all of a sudden, so here they come, and there's frantic action for a short period of time, and then away it goes. Noon, first of all, you know, I wonder how that would all be coordinated, what the cue is for a midday as opposed to an
yeah.
early evening emergence. So I won't say I'm skeptical, but I'm confused. And Larry's more into the fishing end of it than I am. Maybe he's got a comment, but this is really a question for one of our entomology buddies.
Yeah, Phil Pelletieri or PJ Leash, if you guys are, one of you are listening, give us a call, or someone else who may have some information on it, because I'm stumped on that one too. A noon one. Let's see. That's strange for sure. So stay listening, Duke. Maybe we'll have some more answers for you as we move along here. Guy in Grand Marsh has a question or comment. Hi, Guy.
Why, hello. I have a question about crows. I live out in the country, and I feed my neighborhood crows, and there's a family of them living around here. I was wondering if there's any type of way you could build nests and that for crows out of boxes. And if there was, what type would it be, and about how high would you want to go? The reason I ask is because I can't say for 100% sure, but it sounds like there's neighbors around here that I feel them here, and when they fly away, I'm hearing shotgun pops at them. And I'm getting a little worried. I'd like to get them a little closer to safety in my yard if I could.
Well, interesting question. You know, ordinarily, they for nesting, they'll take over an old hawk or owl nest or something like that, and those are where they find them. I don't think they'll respond to nest boxes of any kind,
no
matter how good your intentions are. So, you know, other than picking some trees around your property or near the edge of the yard and, you know, getting up to as high as you can in the first crotch or fork and some big branches or something and maybe piles. I think the easiest way, if you're going to try and make something synthetic or human produced, make a wire frame out of hardware cloth or welded wire fencing or whatever, maybe 2-3 feet in diameter, and then go up and tack that in place in the crotch of a tree and dump some sticks and other debris in there so that it looks to you like a potential nest. And who knows, maybe the crows will respond to it. But of all of the, you're swimming upstream a little bit because crows are often, although they're intelligent, they're interesting. And I spent a lot of time watching their relatives in Alaska, the ravens, which I'm fascinated by. But anyway, they're more often considered something of a nuisance. And as you say, your neighbors may be persecuting them. So do what you can. You might have some luck trying to create nesting. If you're feeding them, they certainly respond to that. And, you know, good luck. But that's probably about all you can do.
Yeah, I think you're right. Guy, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We had Tim Isley emailed a photo of Alaska. It says their favorite place is Juneau, where their son lives. He's sent a photo that's showing how visitors can go to the visitor center and get a close-up view of the glacier that is receding, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the Mendenhall Glacier, and it's about the best known and most accessible in Alaska. And I was the only one, and when we got to Juneau, I took off with a buddy from Juneau when we were out looking for salmon that were running up a local stream to see what was going on. The rest of the group all went to Mendenhall, which is the most popular tourist attraction in Juneau, and that's a really nice picture of it, and it is receding, as are most of the glaciers.
Yeah.
So it goes.
KM emailed to ask if anyone has done research on the decibel level of sandhill crane calls. You can hear them long before you see them. That is, if you have good hearing and a bad eyesight. Or is it their tone that carries so well in the air?
I think it's just a matter of they create a sound that carries very well over distance. And it's very distinctive, kind of a gurgling prehistoric call. And once somebody knows what it is, I think you just kind of get tuned into it. And you do often hear them. You hear them, and then where the heck are they? I think they're over there, and then eventually you see them circling around in the sky, or they're calling and dancing in somebody's wetland maybe half a mile away. So I think it's just a matter of they have a very loud, very well-carried song, as opposed to some birds which are a lot more subtle.
We have a photo. This came up last month, and we didn't have time to get to it, but it's a rabbit eating a bird from the look of it.
Well, we don't have the narrative, so I'm not altogether sure I don't recall what the photographer said about it. It's hard to tell from the picture whether the rabbit actually has a hold of it or is eating it, or whether it's just kind of pushing it out of the way or sniffing it. I don't know. But the point, I guess, to be taken from it is that it's unusual. And if the rabbit was eating it, it is very unusual, but not unheard of. A lot of mammals that you don't think of as being carnivorous or interested in meat will seize the opportunity to grab a nestling bird or an egg or something like that whenever the opportunity presents itself. I remember a field trip with one of my classes a long time ago. We were having a picnic lunch at one of our stables. We were at Goose Pond, the Audubon Society Sanctuary, sitting on the grass, and some sparrows were fledging out of a nest in a bush not very far away, and the one or two young had kind of fluttered across the lawn not very far from us and maybe only a foot off the ground. And all of a sudden, as we were watching, a ground squirrel launched itself up out of the grass. It looked like a Polaris missile leaving a submarine and leaped up as one of these sparrows was fluttering by, grabbed it, dropped back to earth, killed it, and made off with it, presumably for lunch. And, you know, squirrels, gray squirrels, red squirrels, they'll enter a nest or hollow tree and snag a nestling or an egg. So rabbits are not rodents like the ones I mentioned, but who knows? Maybe it was feeling the need for some sort of nutritional supplement that only some meat could provide, and that dead bird apparently provided it. So not impossible, and obviously we've got photographic documentation here. I just don't remember the circumstances from who submitted it.
Lute in River Falls has a question. Hi, Lute.
Hi. I'm hoping Scott can help me with something that's biting me. About this time of year, for the last 3 years, I get some bites. They're not like mosquito bites or gnats. They are much more profound. And the thing is, they last for several weeks, and they itch like I'll get out. And they seem to bite in kind of a grouping. They're not just one here and one there on my body.
Oh.
Yeah.
Could be gnats. Could be black flies.
So you never see anything, Lou,
no,
or feel something
on
you? All of a sudden,
right.
The bite's there.
And I never feel it. I never feel getting bit. And the thing is, they itch profoundly, and they last such a long time. Somebody said spiders.
No, they're probably what they call no-see-ems. And the reason you don't feel them is because they inject a little something into your body when they're biting so that you don't feel them. It's like a Novocaine type of anesthetic that they use.
That's a reasonable suggestion. I'm not sure what else to tell you. I mean, most biting insects, I mean, if you're bitten by a deer fly, for example, you know you're getting bitten for sure.
Yeah, right away.
And even mosquitoes, you'll feel. I just wonder, is it a possibility that it's not even an insect bite, but rather some sort of a plant that's out this time of year? Working in the garden, and I've come up with all sorts of itches and rashes and what seem like bites, and I think it's from working in the prolific weed growth this year, and some of those things are just are irritating. So that's another possibility. So I'm not sure we're going to be able to pin it down for you.
Yeah, there's another one. If you send it to the if you got a photo of your of the area where, you know, the bites are, you could send a photo along with a description to the Insect Diagnostic Lab, and PJ Leash may have some answers for you. So UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, if you send a photo and a description, he'll likely at least have the alternatives for you. So that's the best we can do right now. Let's go to Paul in Madison. Hi, Paul.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, what's on your mind?
Well, when I was a child, and I'm in my 70s now, so we're talking about some time ago, we used to go up to northern Wisconsin lakes, and we would fish. And occasionally, we would think we caught the bottom, and we would fight whatever it was. And finally, we would pull up something we would call a mud puppy.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And they had external gills around the neck, and They were nasty-looking things, but they weren't harmful at all. And I haven't found anything like that in years, and I'm just wondering whether they're one of the extinct species now or what.
No, actually, they're doing just fine. A mud puppy is a salamander, and probably our largest salamander. They're related to an even bigger salamander down further in the Mississippi River called a hellbender, but they're just big, slimy salamanders. And they're interesting, particularly interesting to people interested in amphibians, because they the scientific term for it is neoteny, or they're called neotenic, because the salamander, the mud puppy, never metamorphoses into what would be thought of as an adult salamander. Most of our big salamanders, spotted or tiger salamanders, move to ponds, breed, and then there's a larval form with external gills that looks just like a small mud puppy. But they, like tadpoles, change into the adult spotted or tiger salamander and then leave the pond and go back and live in the woods. The mud puppies breed and reproduce in that larval-looking form with the external gills and in the water. They never leave the water. They're down on the bottom, in amongst the rocks and boulders and debris, and most people never see them unless they look for them when they're spawning in inshore rocky areas. I used to know some of my limnology colleagues who would try and net them on Lake Mendota late in the fall when they spawned, and they claimed the they were pretty sizable and had a meaty tail, and they claimed that was a delicacy. I don't know about that. Their biggest claim to fame is just what you described. Somebody catches one on a hook and line. I've caught them both on a hook and line and on a tip-up in the winter. And then all of a sudden you get this thing in the boat, and their claim to fame is they're unbelievably slimy.
Yeah.
You cannot hardly hold on to one to unhook it. Most people are scared of it anyway and cut the line and throw it overboard. But they're very, very slimy. They never leave the water, and they're basically a big salamander. So, and they're still around. They're not very conspicuous.
I was thinking about one of my musky fishing tackle boxes from years back. I've got, I think I got it from my dad, a mud puppy lure for musky.
Hmm.
And a little black thing, but that's not slimy. Not like the real thing. For sure, I've caught them too on the hook and line, and they're really slimy.
They're really an interesting creature, and about the only chance for anybody to see one is to accidentally catch it while fishing.
Yeah, there you go, Paul. Thanks a lot. Kevin in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. I have a question about the gnats we have around here. I moved to Viroqua about 20 years ago, and they weren't around, and suddenly these biting gnats descended on the town. Well, the whole Driftless area, I think, but no one around here had ever seen them or remembered any problem with them. And then they don't care about normal, DEET-based repellents. Locals swear by vanilla and Absorbine Junior. I'm just wondering, is there a name for these bugs? I've never seen anything like it, except when I lived in Alaska when I was a kid, and there was some stuff like that in the tundra up there. But what are these things?
Well, I'm going to take the fifth again, as I've done on a couple of these calls, Kevin. I think it's clear to me now that next week when Grandparents University starts here on campus, I better take the entomology course with one of the grandkids, because we've had lots of insect questions today, and it's just not my thing. So these are things that, as Larry pointed out, could be easily referred to the insect diagnostic lab, or wait until Larry's got one of the entomologists on as a guest and bring these up again, because I simply can't help you.
I think it may well be a question of the kind of weather and the water and the moisture levels that we've had that maybe has created it. But you're right, Scott. If send a note to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, and PJ Leash may have an answer for you. I am convinced that he has probably had many, many questions about these gnats, and will probably have an answer for you. Thanks for calling. Kent in Reedstown, we'll go to you now. Hi, Kent.
Oh, yeah. I was out the other day, and I saw from a spillway from a reservoir about a 4-foot drop from the spillway from a pond, fish jumping out and trying to get up to the main body of water behind the reservoir. And I assume they're trout, and I'm just wondering, is that a good assumption?
Not necessarily. No. I mean, one of the it would be late in the year for it now, but one of the big attractions near the University Arboretum here in Madison is the muskies coming up from Lake Monona in the creek and then trying to get over a low-head dam into Lake Wingra. And they've got
really fun to watch.
They've got a boardwalk there, and people line up to watch these huge muskies trying to leap up into Lake Wingra. And that's a spawning run, and typically most of those occur in the spring. So we're getting late in the year for any spawning,
yeah.
Although some fish spawn in the fall, but we're kind of in no man's land between spring and fall. So I'm not sure what they were as far as species. They probably weren't trout, but I don't know what they would be unless you can get a better look or a better description. What, did they look big? You said you saw them from a distance.
And what was the water? What lake was it? Was it a lake or a river?
No, it was just just a small pond below a reservoir, and there were small fish. I don't know my fish, but I would say like 6 inches.
Well, another one of those. If we had a photo, you'd probably be able to identify it. But
yeah, and there may be. This is another case where we turn to the listeners, somebody else in that area who may be.
Yeah.
More. Did you see a lot of them? I mean, did it seem like there were schools of them trying to get up there, or just a couple?
Well, no, it was. I was there just a matter of 10 minutes, and I saw probably 10 fish making this jump of about 4 feet up into a pretty good run of water.
There's another option for that too, because I've been in situations where I've seen smaller fish jumping out of the water and back into the water, and it was in that case a muskie was after the school, so there may be another predator fish after them for that 10-minute period. And they were just trying to get away.
Possible, I guess.
That's very possible, actually, I think. So we won't know the fish unless we get a good photo of it, I think, or a better description, probably. There we go, Ken.
Don't know, Ken. Sorry, we're not able to give you a definitive answer, but it just seems like the wrong time of year for a spawning
run. Yeah, it sure does.
6-inch fish don't seem like a mature fish either. So unless
I thought about the predator. If there was a predator, might result
in something they wouldn't otherwise do.
Thanks, Ken. Mike in Winchester, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi there.
Hi.
I got a question. Every year I get golden finches. I usually get, I have my four or five sacks out. Niger seed or thistle seed, and I usually get all kinds of finches. Sometimes I can count 20, 25, possibly 30 on a sacks all around the yard and stuff. This year I hardly have any finches. Yeah, we'll get about maybe, 5, 6 of them in the yard at one time. I'm just wondering if there's a down, something happened that they're down this year. And the hummingbirds, it seemed like they aren't really all that abundant this year. I usually have 15 hummingbirds around the yard. Luckily, I got 6, 7 of them at one time, So I'm just kind of curious what's going on, if there's anything, because of maybe the cold weather, the weather was wet and stuff, maybe something happened. So that's my question.
Well, goldfinches or wild canaries or yellow finches, golden finches, all all the same thing. Formally, they're goldfinches, but in any event, they're very common feeder bird and very popular because they're so brilliant yellow with black wings and all. So that's the bird. It's pretty common and always has been over the years of the program that when something doesn't seem quite right, there's not as many of this, that, or whatever, that the assumption, uh-oh, maybe there's something wrong. Toxicants, weather disasters, but rarely is that the explanation. Far more likely that this is attributed to a weird year. As we've already determined, there's water everywhere. Plant growth is jungle-like. So there's lots of stuff out there. And it's also very late. So some of the things the goldfinches would normally turn to for food, like thistle plants, haven't even bloomed yet for the most part.
Yeah,
That there are some strange things going on in the environment because of the nature of the year. But I've got lots of goldfinches at my feeders. they're in full plumage and they're there. So it could be a local thing, and it's probably brought about by the strange year we're having. So I wouldn't necessarily might give up on them. They may be yet to come. And the same thing with the hummingbirds. I've only had one or two, whereas I normally have three or four, but I'm headed up to northern Wisconsin where they seem to be even more abundant. I'll get another perspective up there.
Friend of mine from northern Wisconsin sent me a little video on Facebook of, I think there were 40 hummingbirds around two of his feeders. I forget how many gallons of water, of sugar water or whatever he was going through, but there were a lot of them there.
Well, that's the thing, really. I'd be happy to trade if somebody has extra hummingbirds or goldfinches. I've got a lot of chipmunks that somebody might be interested in.
There you go.
But that's the thing. These things are all these birds, mammals, amphibians, reptiles are not distributed equally on the landscape. Everybody doesn't necessarily have their perception of a fair share at any given time. And that's one of the things that makes it interesting.
Yeah.
Where are they? They were here today, gone tomorrow, or vice versa. Be patient. There's no calamity that I think we can look at that explains these things.
Scott Craven, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Great to have him along. Give a call with your question at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org and send your photo to ideas@wpr.org as well. Speaking of photos, Kay emailed to say that she is in Ocano. Her home's on the Ocano River in Ocano Falls. She found a snake in her pole barn. It started vibrating its tail, then crawled into a hole in the floor. She thinks it's a western fox snake. Is it okay to leave it to hopefully eat the mice, or is it something she wants to get rid of? And we can't see the whole snake, but looks like a fox snake to me.
Well, it looks like one to me, too. So I think Kay is spot on with her identification. I'm assuming since she made that call, she saw more of it than we did. And what would give it away is the head, which is coppery colored like a penny. But the markings that we can see through the holes sure look like a fox snake, which most people in Wisconsin know as a pine snake. Same thing. And I'm pleased to think that Kay's willing to leave it in the barn to potentially eat mice and so forth. And that's exactly what she should do. So
yeah, don't kill it.
No harm, no foul there.
Yeah. Heidi in Arkansas, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Heidi.
Hi. I have a question about salamanders, the black and yellow spotted ones.
Okay.
I haven't seen one in about 40 years, and I've asked a whole bunch of people, and no one has seen one. And I even asked a fishery and forestry guy, and he said, no, I haven't seen one either in forever. Can you tell me what's going there, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right.
Okay. Well, Heidi, if we're talking about the same ones, So there are a couple of salamanders that are in the same group of salamanders, and they can be up to 10 or 11 or even 12 inches long. They're pretty good size. And one is distinctly spotted, but there's another one that's much more common that also has yellow markings that you could describe as spots, but they're more irregularly shaped, and that's a tiger salamander. So we have spotted salamanders, tiger salamanders, which are closely related. Spotted ones more in northern Wisconsin, tiger salamanders more in most of the state, but particularly in the south. They're still out there, but one of the common names for them is mole salamander because during the bulk of the warm season, they're underground, in the leaf litter, whatever. I've dug them up in my garden when I'm digging potatoes, for example. All of a sudden, whoa, that potato's moving, but it's a salamander. And the only time that people tend to see them is when they migrate from where they overwinter in uplands, and you get a warm, rainy night, even in February, but certainly in March. And these salamanders, during the night, under cover of darkness, it's warm and moist, and boom, they're all on the move to get to the breeding ponds, where they breed over the span of a few days to a couple of weeks, and then the adults are back in the uplands and dig down in the soil and leaf litter, and that's where they spend their time, almost undetectable. People end up getting them in their window wells during that migration, or they see them crossing the road. If you don't happen to be out under those circumstances,
you're not going to see them.
You're not going to see them, but they're out there. There's nothing that I'm aware of going on that suggests that there's anything bad happening as far as the salamander populations. But they're just, you almost have to make the effort to get out and look for them when they're available to see, which is a short window in the very early spring.
Warren in Reidsville, your turn now. Hi, Warren.
Hi. My question is on whippoorwills. Mm-hmm. We've been out in the woods early hunting turkeys since the 80s and used to always hear whippoorwills, and I don't think we've heard one for at least 10 years.
You know, we kind of talked about some of this before, that occasionally there's areas where you don't see them and then you might see them again. Whippoorwills haven't done particularly well, I don't think.
Yeah, that's the problem. In the case of whippoorwills, unlike some of these other birds we've been talking about, like where are the golden finches or where are the hummingbirds, I think if you're so inclined to dig into this a little bit and go online to one of the bird sites like eBird or the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology or the various bird counts that are done and recorded around the country, you'll find that whippoorwills, which are long-distance migrants, have been, at least the last time I checked into it, and it was a while back, were undergoing a slow but steady decline. And therefore, the assumption that there aren't as many as there were is probably true. I can't remember. It's a really interesting call.
Yeah, I love that call.
It's a night call. It's a neat thing. Unless they happen to be sitting on a limb outside your bedroom, then it can get a little annoying because it's a bit of a penetrating call. But I can't remember the last one I heard.
Yeah.
So it's been a while. Whereas when I arrived in Wisconsin quite a long time ago, it was pretty common rural Wisconsin sound. But there has been a decline, so that you're right in that regard. And at this point, I think you'd have to be lucky to be in the right place at the right time to hear one.
Yeah. I like your suggestion about going to eBird. Mm-hmm. Go online to eBird. You can see if there are sightings and so forth of the bird and in what parts of the state where they might have been.
Right.
Yeah. So there you go, Warren. Thank you so much. let's go to Deborah in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Deborah.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Hi. I'm hoping you can identify a snake for me. About 3 or 4 years ago, I was hiking in the Trempler Wildlife Refuge along some water, and I saw this dark snake. It was about a foot long, a really dark green or black, I couldn't tell, and it had very thin, it was about maybe half an inch in diameter, and it had very thin cream color stripes that went around the body. And when I got back to the office area, I asked them about it, but they said, unfortunately, I didn't have a camera, and they said they didn't have any snakes like that in the area.
Well, you threw a curveball at me, Deborah. I was just jotting down the various cream-colored striped snakes and thought we could just pin this down for you pretty quickly, but we can't because all of the cream-colored striped snakes, the the stripes are longitudinal from head to tail, not around. So am I correct in saying that these were like bands of color around the snake rather than long stripes?
Right.
Hmm.
And it was the snake, the body of the snake itself was a dark color.
Well, the longer stripes would have been easier because we have several garter snakes and several ribbon snakes that are, at least in the case of the garter snakes, widespread, and that's where I thought we were headed with this. But a snake with rings on it, essentially,
doesn't exist.
There's no, if you run through a snake guide, you're not going to find a snake with rings on it, except for the fact that juvenile snakes tend to be often very differently marked than the adults. And they're difficult to identify, but a snake only a foot long could have been a young specimen of something larger near the water in that area, like a banded water snake. And the bands may have been lighter color at that point, and that's what you saw.
Yeah. Scott Craven, our guest today, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, emeritus professor. He'll be with us till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back. So you stay with us. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Emeritus Professor from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension. Great to have him back. Lots of calls and questions for you here, Scott. Before we go back to some of our listener questions, I know there were some surveys done on wolves and grouse, the DNR did, and you know, so many people have been worried about grouse first. Maybe what's the situation?
Well, the grouse, the spring drumming count survey is in. It's not a count of grouse by any means, but it's an index to changes from year to year. And a lot of people kind of hang their hats on it when it comes to what's going on with grouse. And as you say, there was
a lot of concern.
There was a lot of concern over the last 2 years when numbers kind of went the wrong way. And there was speculation about problems with West Nile disease, and some of those tests aren't even back yet and whatnot. But the good news is that the statewide survey for this spring, grouse numbers were up 41% statewide. And in the North Woods, the kind of the heart of grouse country in the North Country, up 48%. Which is a big jump.
That's a big jump.
So, but bear in mind that even a large percentage of a small number is still not a huge number. But it's good news, and in areas where people were seeing grouse, there should be noticeably more grouse, which is what's supposed to happen as they're on the upswing of their 10-year cycle. So that's a promising situation.
Yeah.
And people should be, I mean, the people in the North Woods, grouse hunters and other folks interested in grouse should be pretty happy about that. And it does come on the heels of two disappointing years. As far as the wolf situation is concerned, where are my numbers on the wolves? Here we go. So last winter's results from the wolf tracking surveys with about 100 volunteers out. Came back with a minimum population estimate of, and it's always expressed as a range of 914 to 978, which is very similar to the year before, which was 905 to 970, I think it was, something like that, 944. So we're somewhere in the neighborhood of 900 to 950 wolves in the winter. That jumps markedly with reproduction here this time of year and then tails off until next winter. Basically, the wolf population seems to be showing some stability, but it's still way over the established population goals that have been around for a while. And that, of course, is where the controversy is with wolves. You know, really, how many are there really? And some people don't have faith in that estimate. A lot of people do. And then the question is, how many is enough? But that argument will go on for a long time.
And turkeys? Turkey harvest? I know the data's out on that.
Some numbers in on the turkey harvest, too. The harvest overall for the spring turkey hunting season was pretty close to last year's, but below peak years. this past season, 38,500 and some odd turkeys. That's a lot of turkeys harvested. Last year it was just a few more, maybe 300 or 400 more. But, you know, from about 2003 until 2017, with only one exception, the harvest was always in excess of 40,000. And in 07, 08, and 09, it exceeded every year 52,000. So one wonders a little bit what's going on, because I think as over time there have been more and more permits issued, and we went from five-day hunting periods to a full week. So there's more opportunity and presumably more hunters, more tags, and yet fewer turkeys are being killed. It's still a terrific harvest and a great success story, but there was lots of concern that the turkeys weren't very vocal this year because of the screwy weather, which is certainly possible. But, you know, my perception, personally, I'm just one turkey hunter, and the opinion of individual hunters is the bane of professional wildlife managers.
Yes.
Because nobody's ever happy. Oh, I'm not seeing any turkeys. Well, you know, I travel around a bit and talk to a lot of other people, and I personally, and I think that there's some evidence that there just aren't as many turkeys as there may have been 20 years ago or 10 years ago. And that certainly has to weigh in the situation too. However, this is a great case to let the listeners weigh in. And, you know, are you still seeing folks? Are you still seeing large flocks of turkeys out there on the landscape? Because I remember the day when you might see, you'd be driving around in the Driftless area, you might see a wintering flock of hundreds of turkeys.
Not going to see large flocks now, I don't
know.
No,
not this time of year. But, you know, what did you see over winter? What's the listener's opinion on this? But the bottom line was it was another successful turkey season, but there were some glitches brought about by the weather. So,
you know, during our newscast, there was an interesting story about the DNR talking about a fungal disease in snakes. And, Scott, can you shed any light on that?
Yes, I was just reading about that last night, actually, and the DNR and the people in the natural heritage area are looking for folks to report cases of snake fungal disease, known as SFD, and if people see snakes that appear to be affected by this, and what they should be looking for are lumps on the head and neck, and in some cases the body, or unusual lesions or sores, and these tend to impede the snake's ability to feed and so forth. And it has decimated some snake populations in some areas, but they're concerned about what it may mean in Wisconsin. Apparently, about half of our 21 species of snakes have been documented with it so far, especially in the southwestern quarter of the state. So, for anybody who sees a snake that looks a little weird, if they can get a picture of it, they're asking people to send in the information to dnrherpetiles@wisconsin.gov, wi.gov. And you can search for this on the DNR website to find out more information. But if you're into snakes and photograph them a bit, like the caller who sent in the picture of the ringed snake that we were talking about a few minutes ago, and I was at least right about speculating on the northern water snake. I tend to think of a northern water snake as having brown bands and didn't think about the intervening off or lighter colored ring, but it does look like a ringed snake. So I'm pretty sure that's what our previous caller did, in fact, see. But people can help document where this SFD, snake fungal disease, is, and there are lots of other opportunities if you're messing around on the DNR website for citizens to get involved in helping out with wildlife conservation.
You know, we were talking about whippoorwills here a few minutes back, too, and Buck in Bailey's Harbor has something about whippoorwills. Hi, Buck.
Hey, good afternoon. I used to go up to Hayward all the time to the cabin in the late 80s and had whippoorwills all the time. Now, I live up in Bailey's Harbor, about a half a mile from Mud Lake Preserve. And in the last few weeks, we've been hearing whippoorwills at night consistently. So I've never heard them here before in the 17 years I've lived here, and now here they are in Bailey's Harbor. So that's kind of cool.
That is very cool.
It's like the realtor's term, location, location, location. If you're in the right place, you're hearing them. And Peggy and Cindy noted here on the Facebook page that they were singing like whippoorwills were singing like crazy at American Players Theater in Spring Green last night. clear as a bell.
And Buck, where'd you say you were hearing the whippoorwills?
Bailey's Harbor.
Right out of Bailey's Harbor on County Q out by the Mud Lake Preserve.
All right, because I will be in Bailey's Harbor in about 7 or 8 hours. And so I may want to go and listen because I haven't heard a whippoorwill in a long, long time. Thanks a lot for that positive call about whippoorwills, Buck. Appreciate it very much. Yeah, I'll be up in Bailey's Harbor for in that area for...
I hope you're going to have a fish. I hope you're going to have a fish boil.
Well, probably. Christina in Glenwood City, it's your turn. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I have a comment and then a quick question. I recently talked to both of you regarding a raccoon in my home ceiling. Mm-hmm. So I'm following up with the outcome.
What happened?
It took collective wisdom from many wildlife experts. Dan Small referred me to Nancy Frank, and she emailed advice that I followed to a T, and I set my buddy's large, sturdy trap daily, catching about 10 feral cats. And then finally, I got the mama raccoon, who damaged our home soffit and fascia to retrieve 7 babies from my ceiling, mm-hmm. and then closed the entry and sprayed the area with ammonia as advised.
There you go.
And they're gone.
Good advice, and you solved the problem. So all's well that ends well on the raccoon front.
Christina, thank you so much for calling. I love it when we get little updates about topics that we've talked about before. Let's see. We're going to check out another couple of things here. Lisa in East Troy emailed to say that she read yesterday that the commercial mix that you add to water is killing hummingbirds. They're saying the red food color is doing it. Now, I'm not sure, and you and I have talked about this, and why would you want to buy a commercial mix when it's so easy to make it? But
well, I don't know. I suppose it's a convenience thing for some folks, and you could do that. I would – My feeling is that many of the reputable vendors of such things are on top of whatever might or might not be going on. And if this were really a source of mortality for hummingbirds, it would be pulled off the shelves. I have not read those accounts. The red food coloring, there have been lots of controversy over red dye number, whatever it was, in various foodstuffs for a few years, and if that's harmful to hummingbirds, there's no need to use it. But for some reason, the myth persists that the liquid you're feeding should be red. But if you look at all the commercial hummingbird feeders, you know, unless you're just inverting a 2-liter soft drink bottle and filling it with something, they all have some bright color on it that tends to attract the hummingbird's attention. And there's no need at all for the actual sugar water solution to be red. So don't do it. Don't add your own food coloring and don't necessarily take a product that may have red coloring, although I don't really know whether they do or not. So the caller didn't say anything about the source of that account, that this was a source of mortality, but you don't need the red coloring, and it's easy to do 4 parts of water to 1 part sugar and boil it, let it cool, and use that, and it works fine for me.
Works like a charm, actually. You know, this month's issue of the DNR magazine has got some great stories. And there's one on, I think the cover story is on trumpeter swans.
Yeah, there's a very nice cover photo of a couple trumpeter swans. And the lead article or story in the magazine is written by two of my personal friends who were longtime biologists, now retired with the DNR, who really oversaw the restoration program for trumpeter swans almost 30 years ago. They led the charge to fly to Alaska, collect trumpeter swan eggs, bring them back to Wisconsin, They were incubated at the Milwaukee Zoo and very successfully. And then this goes through first person, the two guys who were doing the work,
yeah,
along with many cooperators. And it led to, this was started in 1989 when the birds had been extirpated. I'm trying to remember how many eggs they brought back in the first round. But the goal for the swan program that started in 1989 was to have 20 breeding pairs in Wisconsin by the year 2000. Now, from those eggs that were hauled back from Alaska in 1989, 30 years ago, we have over 5,000 swans in Wisconsin.
Isn't that cool?
And it's a tremendous success story, and this article is written in great detail by the people who lived it and did it, and it makes for, and it's nicely illustrated. So it's a neat story. It's a nice magazine, and I'm glad they're still publishing it.
Yeah, so am I.
Since it was on the chopping block a while back.
Ken in rural Steuben emailed that last week he had a doe and four fawns in his backyard. One appeared to be much smaller, one kind of middle size, the other two a bit larger. They were playing around for a while with no doe showing up. That's not unusual. Will a doe adopt the young of another doe that's met an untimely end?
Yes, I can see there are events where something happens to another doe. They're in part of a group. All of a sudden, the fawns are tagging along, but it's also possible four fawns, although it's a large number for an individual doe, is documented, and that's a lot of them. And when that's a matter of the doe trying to take care of a large group like that, there's also a possibility that there's a, I don't want to call it the run to the litter, because we don't think of litters when it comes to deer, but there's also some potential for differential growth, so that could explain it too. Could be all belonging to that doe, could have been some from another doe or a related doe, or even the doe's daughter's fawns, born a little later. So who knows? But there are several explanations. It does happen.
Let's go to lightning bugs for a minute. Kenneth wanted to know if lightning bugs stop flashing when it's lightning out. And I can tell you that I was sitting out and it was lightning outside and there were lightning bugs lighting up.
There are gazillions of them over our prairie as we sit out there. And I don't think that a passing storm affects them very much. I don't know whether they do the competition for the light or whatnot, but I don't think that's an issue.
Karen emailed a photo of a rabbit. She says it doesn't have any ears, and it's been around since last winter. Any idea what might have happened to the ears? And it is hard to – it doesn't look like it has ears, but then again
– Well, I don't know. From the picture, it almost looks like the near ear in the picture, which is the only one we could see, is actually flopped down behind the eye. And so but either way, there's something wrong with the ears. Either the cartilage in the ear is undeveloped or damaged or whatnot, so the ear is lying flat against the side of the head, or it's gone. I can't tell from the picture. But what you can tell is the rabbit doesn't look particularly thrifty. The hair is blotchy and so forth. So
yeah.
I don't know what's going on with it, but that's not necessarily a healthy rabbit, and whether it's a genetic issue that did something to the ears or basically a health or disease issue, I have no idea.
Tom emailed wondering about the bull snake in northern Wisconsin, if it's in decline. It's one person say rare to see a large one anymore.
I'm trying to
they were
find that
common
here
50 years ago, and so were leopard frogs. Just below the
below
photo
the snake
of the rabbit.
Okay. From Tom. Well, I mean, for one thing, if you pick up the DNR's snake guide, which is a wonderful reference to the snakes of Wisconsin, I don't believe that bull snakes were ever particularly common in northern Wisconsin. Fox snakes, yes, and to the casual observer, at least, they're pretty darn similar.
Yeah.
The stronghold for bull snakes is more west central and southwestern Wisconsin, And there's still quite a few of them there, including some large ones at the places we take our classes. So I'm not sure what to say about that, whether there's a case of mistaken identity or not. But in the case of fox snakes, which are often in communal hibernacula that have been persecuted, there have been some local population declines. And whether Tom is in the area of one, I'm not altogether sure. Leopard frogs have suffered from a number of different or several different disease problems, red leg and other fungal diseases that have reduced some populations. So I agree with that. They do not seem to be as common as they once were. In some of our bigger wetlands, there were gazillions of them. It's a very technical, mathematical term. But so there is an issue there with a health issue for the particular frog. As far as the decline in bull snakes, I don't think that's
the case.
You ought to look at the range map and see what's what.
We have the 4th of July coming, obviously, tomorrow night. There are going to be a lot of fireworks going off. And wondering if those that are exploded over water, which are in a lot of cases, Bailey's Harbor is an example, Madison's an example, Milwaukee has a huge fireworks over the water. Is that a hazard to fish and waterfowl?
Well, one would think that some of the debris raining down or the with the residual of whatever the powder is and so forth can't be a good thing. But I got to think that this is one of those cases where it's such a visible thing. And it's done for the public. There are many people watching these exhibits. There was a cartoon in the Madison paper that explored this, I think, just yesterday. But there are enough people concerned and enough people watching, including people with some responsibility for regulation of these things, for water quality and so forth, that if this were a measurable or serious problem, there'd be some other alternative for the fireworks. I can't say any more about that than that.
Somebody else was wondering if there are any, are you going to catch any fish this week in northern Wisconsin?
Yes, I will. I'm extremely capable in that arena, and I do plan to catch a lot of fish and big ones.
And big ones. Yes. Buskies?
No.
No.
No, I do not have the patience to be a musky fisherman.
Yeah, just leave that to me.
I'll leave that to you, and I intend to return virtually all those fish to the water.
Well, good for you. So do I.
Because I've already obtained the necessary annual quota of crappie fillets, which we'll be frying up tomorrow night.
Good for you, Scott. Happy 4th to you.
You too and all the listeners.
Scott Craven, our guest today, emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. He's going to be back on September 4th, and we'll do this all over again with him. Tomorrow at this time, we'll be talking psychological healing after a major health event and also music that can put you in a better mood. That's tomorrow at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, hey, thank you so much for listening. Have a safe 4th, and in the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.